This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here for this, our final episode before the 96th Academy Awards, with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hello.
And with Kara Warner.
Hello.
This is our predictions episode. We are going to put our heads together and predict what will win all of the Oscars on Sunday night. David and Kara and I wrote our predictions at VF.com. You can read those as well. Although I don't think it's a spoiler, because sometimes we disagree with each other, as I think you might hear in the conversation ahead. But before we dive in, I did want to say thank you so much to everyone who submitted their voice memos about their Oscar viewing traditions. Hopefully you listened to Tuesday's episode, in which we played a lot of those. There were a lot that came in that we just didn't have time to include. We recorded too early, but we've listened to all of them. They are really delightful. Richard, you and I were kind of watching the emails come in together, and our listeners are just great. And I wanted to say that on the air, too.
Not to encourage like an onslaught of email, but we see every email and we read them and we listen to them.
And we are delighted by them.
Yes.
And then also thank you to everyone who's participating in our Oscar pool. Go check that link on Sunday night. You'll be able to see your standings update live. I will certainly be checking it. I haven't made my picks as I record this. So if you have the link, if you're signed up and haven't made your picks, please do that. And if you received a link and you haven't clicked it yet, sorry, we're full. We would really like to expand it next year. Really, the response has been fantastic. So those of you who are joining us, feel lucky. You got a spot that not everybody did. And hopefully you can come join us on Sunday night.
And if you see a predictor named Test Case, that's me. And I can't figure out how to change my name.
I'm scared. What is my name? I don't even know.
Test Case 2.
I'll go back and check and see if I can help you out. But when you win and you won't be allowed to win, that way Test Case can win and make off with all the riches.
That's how I do a lot of scams that way. Yeah.
Okay. On with the predictions part of the episode. As usual, I think in years past, we've started with the shorts because, of course, we discussed them in depth a couple weeks ago. So we can go through them fairly quickly. I think we tried to make some predictions about what we thought would win when we discussed these. And the only one I remember feeling fairly certain about was Best Documentary Short. I feel still pretty strong that The Last Repair Shop is going to be the winner here. But I feel like someone disagreed when we had this conversation. Do you guys remember?
Well, Kara and I thought Nai Nai and Wipo would win, maybe. But I've read one of those anonymous ballots and they picked The Last Repair Shop, so I'm like, okay, so one voter told me they're voting for Last Repair Shop, so that's gonna win.
Beware of the anonymous ballots. If anyone remembers my Penelope Cruz prediction from a few years ago,
that was based on more than just the anonymous ballots.
It was, but there are so many that loved Penelope Cruz and Parallel Mothers. I agree though, Katie. I think The Last Repair Shop is just the most well-rounded, particularly in terms of what they look for in this category. It's always hard to predict them. We're often wrong, but it just felt like a winner to me. I think Nai Nai and Wipo, well, one of my personal favorites in the category, it just feels a tad slight for how they tend to vote here. I think if anything, they would probably go with an ABCs of book banning or something like that if they went in another direction. Something that's issue driven from someone, from a peer in Sheila Nevins. That may be a little drier, but still feels important, quote unquote.
Yeah, I felt like you both did a great job of convincing me my initial instinct was maybe not correct because I don't know the history of the category. But Last Prepare Shop, again, is my favorite. And hearing that you guys said, well, you know, they look for an actual full arc of a story and they love something in LA. So
they do.
You know,
they really do.
I'm comfortable with that one.
David, you wrote our predictions for Best Animated Short, which I don't think I had realized how tough of a choice it was until I kind of watched you wrestle with what you considered the top two contenders. So maybe I'll let you kind of explain the stakes there.
A Study in Extremes. yeah, I was between Letter to a Pig, which is very arty and ambiguous and confusing at times, and War is Over, inspired by the music of John and Yoko, to give it the full name, which is none of those things, and I think fits into a certain niche of slightly saccharine, slightly overbearing short winners. But Letter to a Pig also has the theme of the Holocaust as pretty central to it. And as we've seen with the Academy, that can implore a little bit more attention to be paid. And so I do think that in this case, because it is also a very thoughtfully and intricately made short, that could take it over the top. But I think I'm not confident in that.
I think War is Over is going to take it, just because you had said that the whole Academy, the voting body can vote on this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think people that maybe didn't see them, if they see John and Yoko, maybe they have warm feelings and are like, oh, this should win. But who knows?
I agree.
That's a decent point. If they didn't watch them, they're just like, yeah, I like them. Let's do it.
I agree with you, Kara. I have to diverge from our official selections on this one. I think I'm cynical. I mean, after the Kobe Bryant thing won,
you are.
They like celebrity. They like easy kind of sentiment. Letter to a Pig is beautifully made, and in really in blending, I believe, actual video footage and animation, and it's really interesting. But War is Over looks like a Pixar movie. It's a very easy message of war is bad, and then you have the celebrity names at the end.
I think I'm also going to go with War is Over for the, I don't want to be cynical because I don't like, it's not a cynical movie for all the things that you can say about it. But yeah, I think the not the boy and the pig and the fox and the mole and the boy, there's no heron
the
in that
the
one,
Yoko
whatever
sounds
that one
right
was.
To me.
if we want to use that as a model, I think that's a safer one to go with.
Yeah.
Sorry, David. You can be smug and right. Who knows?
Yeah.
I'm
going
to be smug, pretentious, and hopefully right. And I'll stick with Letter to a Pig.
Well, Kara, you took over writing for Live Action Short and wrestled with someone who's been accused of being smug and pretentious, but I would argue is not, which is Wes Anderson, who is
my peer.
definitely, there's a couple celebrity names in this category. He's definitely the biggest one, and you predicted he might win it all.
Yes, when I went back and kind of dug into, I didn't realize how many times he's actually been nominated. And so I think this is a case where people, especially maybe because the voting body is like, well, we don't love his features enough to give it an Oscar, but he made a short film and it's charming. So I think he's going to get an Oscar here, even though I agree with our favorite, Night of Fortune was a tremendous live action short. It was very moving and had some surprises, which I really loved. And then one thing about the Wes Anderson is it was fun to kind of dig into his history. Like he kind of started with a live action short, debuted at Sundance in 1993, Bottle Rocket. So I thought that was a fun little tidbit. I'm like, oh, you know, kind of full circle. If he came onto the scene with a short that people did love, he can win an Oscar for one.
Yeah. I do feel like the cynical choice in this category is The After. It's backed by Netflix. It's got a big star in it and David Oyelowo. It's kind of sad and emotionally pummeling in a way that things often tend to be in winners. Like Henry Sugar is very elaborate, is so technically accomplished, but what it's about is like, I don't know, what is it about? Like,
exactly.
Give away your money if you get the chance.
What and is it about?
Sometimes that can be a challenge. I think I will predict Henry Sugar for myself as well, because I don't want to be cynical in this case, even though I was in the other ones. But The After would maybe be the smarter money, but I'm torn.
I don't think you're cynical, though. Like, I don't think that's a cynical choice, right? People do love a more famous actor emoting in a short. So that's true. Think that's too cynical.
I predicted Knight of Fortune because maybe that was more hope dicting, I guess. But I, in that one anonymous ballot that I read, they brought up an interesting point, which is that the short film categories are viewed by some as a launching pad for new filmmakers, and that Wes Anderson doesn't really belong there because he's very established. You think about filmmakers who have won shorts in the past. David Frankel, director of Devil Wears Prada, is an Oscar winner for a short film. And I was thinking maybe they would want to go with that. So maybe The After is a better pick because it's English language. But Knight of Fortune is the one, as we talked about on our shorts episode, like, is the most complete film, I think, of the mm-hmm. five. So I'm saying that they're going to choose artistry over anything else and vote for that.
Fair.
It's an unusual dynamic for this category. I mean, I would also predict Henry Sugar just because it is in such a league of its own among this group for many reasons. But it's interesting because I think we all have different alternates. Like, I feel like Red, White, and Blue is the film that would make the most sense as an upset because it is the most clearly issue-driven and the clearest kind of counter-programming to Henry Sugar. We've talked a lot about, you know, the Academy's relationship with history, with opinion of Wes Anderson. And this is an interesting test of that for a number of reasons.
This one might be, of the shorts, the one I'm most interested to see what actually triumphs. Like, it's not even... I mean, obviously, if Wes Anderson wins an Oscar, it'll be a moment of celebration. And thank God it's on the telecast this year, unlike when Riz Ahmed won his Oscar in live action short and nobody saw it happen. And then if he doesn't, it'll be very interesting to see what they go for instead. Okay, we'll move on to Best Original Score. I wrote our prediction for this, but I'm imagining you guys all agree with me that Ludwig Göransson will win his second Oscar for Best Original Score for Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I need to make my case?
Does that score ever stop? I mean, it's the whole movie.
I mean, same with editing, though, and we'll get to that, too. Like, the experience of Oppenheimer is being kind of, like, strung along on this like unbroken narrative with the editing and the score kind of working in concert together. You really can't imagine the movie working without both of those things.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge movie score nerd. I'm still psyched Laura Karpman got a nomination here. Mm-hmm. Cause that score is really lovely. And, it's a great category. John Williams has not won as many Oscars as we think he has.
Was it five?
Yeah, just five.
Five is a lot of Oscars, Karen.
I think he's been nominated over 20 times, at least. I gotta know my John Williams facts better.
No, John Williams has been nominated more than you think because they like split it up into like comedy and drama score for a while. And he's got some song nominations. Like, it's a lot of nominations.
Right. I think he's the most nominated person, right?
I think it's like he's about to catch up to Walt Disney, maybe.
Yeah, you're right.
Go for it, John.
Yeah, but this is great. All these, you know, worthwhile scores to listen to. But yes, we're all right.
Yeah. I was fascinating learning about Jerskyn Fendricks, the composer of Poor Things, when writing up this blurb. He's just like an English musician who's been in a bunch of bands. This is the first time he's ever done the score for a movie. It's just fascinating to see him next to John Williams, who's written the most iconic movie scores of the last 50 years.
Right.
Go ahead, Kara.
No, I was going to say, Jerskyn, am I pronouncing? I mean,
not a clue. I do not know that.
Love the name. Need to learn how to pronounce it. But he also, interestingly, composed all the music before they even shot the movie.
Oh, that is interesting.
Really, and Jerskyn Fendricks represented District 5 in the last Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Sorry, that is a Suzanne Collins sounding name, isn't it?
It really is. You're right. One last thing, though, is that to Robbie Robertson, who got a posthumous nomination for his score for Killers of the Flower Moon, you can imagine in a different kind of race there being so much sentimental power behind this. His collaboration with Scorsese went on for so long. You watch The Last Waltz and your heart just kind of breaks in a million pieces knowing it's the beginning of this long friendship. And the score for Killers of the Flower Moon is really fantastic. I don't think that will be enough for him to beat something as powerful as the Oppenheimer score, but I'm glad it's getting a moment all the same.
Yeah.
Okay, David, you took on my real beloved category, original song. I was very generous in letting you write about the contenders this year.
Well, you know, maybe not so much suspense this year. But
well, I guess that's the question, right? It's boiling down to two Barbie songs, and we kind of feel like we know where this is headed. But, do you think there's any possibility for a surprise there?
I don't. I think this is one case where, you know, you're not going to see vote splitting. You're going to see Barbie just at the top of the ticket, top two. I'm sure I'm Just Ken will get some support, but, you know, What Was I Made For is just on another level. It has won a top Grammy, which is very unusual for movie songs. It won Best Song. It's become the sort of emotional anthem of the movie right alongside Dua Lipa's song in the more, you know, fun category. So it just feels like, especially since Barbie has lost some steam outside of this category, that this is the place. It will be honored. It is a great song. You mentioned Robbie Robertson. I am a huge fan of Killers of the Flower Moon. I've been generally bummed that it's just faded so much outside of Best Actress. But a Song for My People, I'm so thrilled it's nominated here. And I feel like it will be a real moment on the telecast. And in another year, I think it could have had a Natu Natu-esque run because it's a really powerful song and one that I think signals the unique contributions made to that movie that came in a little bit later in the development process.
Yeah, we're going to get a lot of good performances. There's going to be a lot of good performances, I think. I mean, Jon Batiste is an incredible performer. Yep. I assume Diane Warren will be on stage with Becky G to perform the Flamin' Hot song. She usually is.
The idea of Becky G at the Oscars is so wild.
With Diane Warren.
With Diane Warren.
Side by side.
And I assume, there was a while where I thought they might open the show with I'm Just Ken. I now think they're going to save it for as long as possible and make everyone keep watching for I'm Just Ken. Yeah. That's my official
That's
prediction.
Actually smart. What will open? What Was I Made For? I don't remember in recent memory, like, a song from a movie sort of becoming so ubiquitous so quickly. Mm-hmm. Mm. I also love it. I am such a sucker for this song. I think it's just gorgeous poetry. It makes you feel the feels in as many cliched ways as it is. And I can't believe that Billy and Phineas, as young as they are, can just do what they
win do. Win a second Oscar. Yeah.
I think they should. You know, this is the first one's going to not look as good. In retrospect, this is one they should win for. It's a great win.
Yeah. But Diane Warren's gonna say, "Oh, it's great that these 20 somethings have won 2 competitive Oscars." How exciting!
Well, especially because they won for Spectre and beat out Lin-Manuel Miranda for the wrong Encanto song. We talked about that at length. But the fact that Lin-Manuel Miranda doesn't have an Oscar is gonna get weirder and weirder as the years go by. So it would just be so easy if we could just swap all that out.
Yeah.
Also, Mark Ronson already has an Oscar for Shallow, so it's not like he's losing, but I would vote for I'm Just Ken any day of the week.
Yeah, I think if people are considering putting Just Ken on their ballots, the one metric to maybe look at is that the comedy songs rarely win. They get nominated, they perform Blame Canada at the Oscars, but it doesn't win, you know?
That's true.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, "Who the heck is that?"
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, on to production design. Speaking of Barbie and where it stands in the race, I mean, in our David and Kara and I, we did a rundown of the races that are so close, and we lumped together costume and production design because it is in many ways Poor Things versus Barbie in both. But let's talk about them separately. Kara, you wrote up our production design predictions. What are the stakes here?
We used the word wrestled, and this one I really am struggling with because Poor Things has won, I think, more of the precursors, and it is a gorgeously designed film. Unique, gorgeous. But Barbie, I mean, I just want Barbie to win more Oscars than Best Song. And I think in chatting with you all, this one, the projected winner here, I leaned a little into what I want and hope for, that Barbie does win. But I just hesitated just because Poor Things is really beloved, especially in the craft categories. So yeah, I'm struggling with this one.
Yeah, my brain is telling me it's going to be Poor Things and my heart is telling me it's going to be Barbie.
Yes.
So I'm right there with you, Kara. The math ain't mathing for Barbie right now.
I know.
Poor Things won with the Art Directors Guild over Barbie. And I feel like Barbie's more of a guild movie than Poor Things. So that probably shouldn't have happened if it were going to win the Oscar. And Poor Things also won the BAFTA, which we talked about a lot. Poor Things really performed well there. But there is something about Barbie as a particularly American phenomenon. There is something in the back of my head that says it will do a little bit better at the Oscars than it does at other award shows. And that may be very naive. But this feels like the category where the work was so brilliant and so visible, you know, just in the marketing alone, that I think it could win. I really do. And I kind of hope it does. It feels like it's just such an iconic, it was kind of the look of the movies, right? In many ways last year. But again, it's just, it hasn't gone its way so far. So logically, it feels kind of foolish to predict it. But that's where I am right now. I feel like this is a place where it could surprise.
Yeah. One other aspect of the argument I added with our predictions is just, was there anything more delightful than the switch from Barbie's Dream House to the Mojo Dojo Casa House?
True.
And is it going to be referenced? You know, it just, that was just such a hilarious, and it is frequently referenced to this day. Not to take away from the amazing European flair. I don't know what the architecture is called, but it's, but yeah, we'll see.
It's flary.
It's been a while since at the Oscars we had a movie that had such huge pop culture impact. Like, I am trying to even think of the last time there was something like this widely nominated at the Oscars that like inspired TikTok trends, as you pointed out, Kara, that people are like sharing their own Mojo Jojo Casa House. Barbie is just so massive in so many of these categories, and it makes me really want, despite the incredible craft of Poor Things and some of the other nominees here, it makes me want them to just say, like, look, you created something that will be with us forever, and it deserves to get recognized.
It's very different than Top Gun, but it's sort of the Top Gun of the year in some ways.
Yeah. I don't think Top Gun had the same kind of, like, instantly recognizable iconography, you know? Like, I don't think it was as pervasive.
But it won Best Sound, which it was not assured, but it did pull something out. And that did feel like a, let's make sure it has a moment. And mm-hmm. Barbie's in a different position because it is winning song. But I think Barbie could similarly pop in another area that it hadn't popped at other award shows.
I think you're all nuts. Yeah. The TikTok I follow, everyone's doing Napoleon Chic. I mean, it's just, I can't get away from it.
You've curated your algorithm well, Richard.
I predicted Poor Things because I just think there are enough snoots in the Academy that just don't want to vote for Barbie, but I'm probably wrong.
The snoots, you're too, I mean... Yeah, I'm the most worried about them, too. Darn it. Come on, Smith. Yeah.
I am going to split the difference, I think, and say production design would be Poor Things. Because, like, you think of, like, the visuals of Poor Things. You think of those crazy, like, Lisbon houses all kind of, like, stacked on top of each other. Maybe more than costumes. I mean, this feels like kind of, like,
interesting.
The cowards
way
up for myself. Okay,
yeah,
see?
I think...
Well, we'll get to costumes a little bit where we'll have this conversation all over again. But I'm gonna stress about this one for a while, which is why we put it in the races that are still too close to call lineup. Okay, speaking of that, visual effects is another one, which is such an oddball category because Oppenheimer is not present. We got an interesting listener email kind of suggesting it might have been Nolan's kind of snobbiness about digital effects that made the visual effects branch be like, nope, you can't be part of our party this year. And I have no way to confirm this, and I would like to do more reporting on it. But however it happened, Oppenheimer was not on the shortlist. It is not nominated. So the nominees are The Creator, which has been winning. It won a lot of Visual Effects Society awards. It's a kind of famously low budget, really beautifully rendered digital effects film. Godzilla Minus One, which is a very similar thing and had the benefit of being a hit when it opened in December. And then kind of more standard blockbusters, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1. And then TikTok's own Napoleon in their visual effects. Yeah. Somehow not nominated in sound. We'll get to that in a minute. I went with Godzilla Minus One kind of on a guts feeling only. Obviously, the creator has done really well within the industry, but like the creator is not a movie that most people remember at all. And when you've got the broader Academy voting in this, like I don't think there's really deep wells of affection for Guardians of the Galaxy or Mission Impossible. Obviously, there's respect for Napoleon. It's nominated in a few other places. But Godzilla Minus One was such a fun success story. You know, it opened around the same time as Boy and the Heron. So it was these two Japanese films really dominating the U.S. box office for a while. I think in the absence of some really compelling narrative, that would be just enough to put it over the top was the case I made.
I think you're right. And I think it has the added benefit that one of the nominees, Takashi Yamazaki, also directed the movie. So yeah, it's a right? way to give the director of this great crossover hit that actually I was listening to Blank Check and they were talking about it, like did better in the US than it did in Japan. And maybe that's just because of population size or whatever, but like it was a fun story, you know, to have this Japanese film do so well in the US and that the director happened to have done a lot of the special effects himself, I think helps its narrative a bit.
I also think Godzilla, Takashi also had my favorite, like moving, cute award season moment. I think it was at the luncheon, David, can maybe correct it, where Steven Spielberg approached him and said he had watched his movie three times.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. I was like,
I believe it was.
That's great.
That's what you want. Like, what? I just feel like the reverence for Godzilla Minus One is great. I mean, people really love it. But yeah, that has been my favorite little award season tidbit so far. Because it's like, can you imagine making a movie and Spielberg telling you he watched it more than once.
I
mean, that's
what, I really wonder what Amblin is setting up for Yamazaki. Like, what his next movie is going to be. Like,
yeah.
Something big, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's a fun category. I think a lot of these movies can win. I probably would predict Godzilla Minus One, too. It's been fascinating to see the creator on the run that it's on, just given it was so quiet when it was released. I still think that winning visual effects groups is one thing, but being able to win with the whole Academy is a much, you know, more daunting task. And Napoleon, you know, on the contrary, is the movie that probably the Academy has seen the most, that was the most heavily campaigned, is the most nominated of the bunch. So I think it can win too in the same way like a First Man won, even though it wasn't widely embraced. So we'll see. I think it'll be exciting whoever wins because I don't think any of these movies are winning anything else.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, I mentioned Best Sound, where Napoleon kind of mystifyingly was not nominated despite all those cannon booms. But David, as you wrote about in our predictions, there is a little bit of suspense here, I think, even though Oppenheimer sure is loud and sure doesn't do a lot with sound and then a very noteworthy lack thereof. But it could get beaten.
Yeah, I am pulling for the zone of interest here. And what a brilliant campaign. Really from the jump, from the moment that movie kind of started the Fall Festival rounds, that was the narrative that A24 was pushing for this movie. The use of the soundscape of this mm-hmm. house being next door to Auschwitz and hearing those horrors up against this very routine, mundane depiction of a Nazi family's life. And they have so consistently sold that story that it has taken it very far. It is not typical for a German language, action-free drama to appear in Best Sound. It won the BAFTA, so it has incredible momentum here. And the fact that the branch lobbed for it in the way they did is a great signal. It's just such an atypical winner, and Oppenheimer is such a typical winner. So it's very hard to imagine it happening, but it can happen. I feel like of the phase two, you know, momentum swings, the Zone of Interest is one movie that just seems to have really taken hold of this voting block. Natasha Lyonne introduced it at the Producers Guild Awards. I had moderated an event that Jennifer Lawrence hosted. And then, of course, you also have this other, you know, chunk of the Academy who is just, you know, considers this a gravely important and timely movie. So regardless of for the reasons why, as we've talked about. So I really believe it can pull off an upset here. I did predict Oppenheimer in the end because, as we've seen with Best Picture winners that are as strong as it, they tend to overperform. And this is a race where it would be surprising if it lost.
Do you think The Zone of Interest has a ton of nominations and a ton of support? Would, you know, some of the voters, in trying to be a little democratic with their votes, could this be their one win?
Well, that's the thing, is I don't think, you know, it's the only below the line nomination for the movie. And it's not, you know, it is going to win international feature, which we'll talk about.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes.
But that's its own kind of thing, right? You know, if you want to put your weight behind it, it's definitely not winning screenplay. It's definitely not winning director. It's definitely not winning picture. So this is the place to give it a special moment and recognize the craft behind it.
And I will say, you know, I don't know about you, David, or Kara, who also do Q&A stuff, but like, when I did a Q&A for Zone of Interest in New York, Johnny Byrne was there and he was part of the panel.
Yeah, I did one with him too.
And so H24, like you mentioned when you wrote it up, like they've really been campaigning it. And those screenings are for Academy members. And I don't think that the sound designers for Oppenheimer have been doing that kind of press, you know, or that sort of campaigning in the same way. And so maybe the name is just sticky enough in people's heads. They're like, oh, he had really interesting things to say about how they did the sound for this movie, where sound is so important. I do kind of agree with you, David, that like, that the Oppenheimer sweep will take sound with it. But there's a strong case to be made that Zone of Interest has just, being a rare movie that is doing a sort of mainstream campaign for a smaller technical category.
Yeah, I like that.
I will note that on the team for Oppenheimer sound is Kevin O'Connell, who has been nominated, I think, 20 times in this category and did not win until Hacksaw Ridge in 2017. He had kind of one of those infamous Oscar streaks like Diane Warren, basically. I think Oppenheimer's going to win. I've been thinking a lot about what you said, David, about when something is a front runner. It's people want to vote for it more. Like they yes. It's not like they look
We've
at their
seen
ballot
this again and again.
Yeah, like they just go down there like, yep, again and again. I mean, the exception to that, and this is a really different thing, like last year was Everything Everywhere, but All Quiet on the Western Front was kind of running away with all those technical awards. And Sarah Polley stopped it in the adapted screenplay category. And I don't know that sound works exactly the same way. I think that's the exception you might be looking for. But I think as incredible as the sound and sort of interest is, and as wise as it has been for them to promote it and make it not like some delicate little like foreign film, like something really massive technical accomplishment. Oppenheimer is also a massive technical accomplishment. And I think I would stick with that one personally.
Yep. I think you're right. We haven't had a front runner that's also a massive technical accomplishment in a while.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
But if you look at a Dune from 2 years ago, it won basically every technical award, even though the director's branch didn't even nominate Denis Villeneuve. When they seem to lock into one movie, and they did that with All Quiet to an extent last year, they just tend to win a lot.
Man, we're going to get to talk about Dune 2 at length, finally, when we do our year-ahead Oscar predictions, now that I finally see it. Cannot wait to talk about all the Oscars we think it's going to win.
This season would have been crazy if Dune were still in.
Yeah. It would have been really stressful. And, like, poor Warner Brothers, whatever. But, like, they would have had Barbie and Dune 2, like, all trying to go up against Oppenheimer. Would have been insane. I think it worked out for the best on many levels.
A friend who is in our field and close Oscar follower texted me and said, wow, I can't believe that the Best Picture winner came out in March, convinced that Dune 2 is just going to run
really?
Away with it. Yeah.
Hey, all right. Stay. Tune in about two weeks.
Saving it.
We'll get to all of that.
I say nomination, not winner.
Yeah. Kara, you read about the hair and makeup category, where much like Oppenheimer and visual effects, Barbie did not make the short list for hair and makeup, which is madness. But here we are. So what do you think is going to win instead?
I think this is where Maestro gets a trophy. I just think that, you know, Maestro is respected and I don't think it's going to win anywhere else. And the makeup artist, the lead makeup artist, Kazuhiro, I hope I'm pronouncing it right. He won for The Darkest Hour, I believe. And
Bombshell, I think.
Oh, yes, Bombshell. Yeah. Excellent memory, David. I think it's, you know, one of the hugest talking points, I guess no pun intended, was Bradley's transformation. You know, there was some of the kerfluffle about the nose or whatever, but, you know, the transformation was a selling point for the movie early on, and the hair and makeup are the reason it was effective. So I think I'm pretty confident predicting Maestro here. Unless the Academy now hates it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I wonder if the nose was like offensive enough that people, there was controversy about it. Maybe that helps right. it because it's like, oh, what movie had makeup this year? Oh, right. The nose thing. Just vote for that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going right. with Poor Things because of the Willem Dafoe stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think that you're right that the combination of a talked about bit of prosthetics and a revered master in Kazuhiro, like I think maybe you're right that Kara, that Maestro just has the juice behind it.
Yeah, I think that the real person factor is probably what would take Maestro over the top. The work is so exacting, and again, Netflix, in the same way we were talking about A24 was Zone of Interest, Netflix really centered Kazuhiro's work from the very beginning of that campaign, in part because of the strikes, and there wasn't a lot of other things that they could talk about, sadly. But still, they very effectively put him to the fore of this race. It's very close, though.
Yeah.
I think Kara has a very valid point that the narrative around Maestro is just, it's gotten a little rough.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that people in the Academy don't like it, but when this kind of thing spirals, it just becomes a movie that people don't necessarily want to vote for. And it happens every year. It becomes out of the campaign's hands, I think, to an extent. I don't know if Maestro's there. That probably will be the determining factor. But Poor Things is just in such a fascinating spot. Like, it could win 0 or it could win 5 very easily, and this is one of those that it's just on the edge for, but it would be a kind of atypical winner because it is not biographical when it does have a real biographical challenger.
I think that on Monday, when we do our post-Oscars episode, we'll have another Netflix conversation and how they did this year, because it is very possible, I think based on what we're predicting, is that they would get for Best Live Action Short for Wes Anderson and Makeup, and that would be it. And they would have spent who knows how much money to get those two relatively mm-hmm. below-the-line Oscars. I don't know. The Maestro postmortem is something I think we've been doing for months, kind of in slow motion. I don't know how much there is to say, but as much as Kazuhiro's work really deserves a win, I think that would be kind of a disappointing outcome for a lot of the people behind Maestro.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's already disappointing, right? That's
sure.
This is the saving grace if they can get it.
Yeah. Although not for nothing, I interviewed the makeup designer for Society of the Snow, also a Netflix movie. The makeup in that movie is pretty incredible. I'm not sure that it popped enough to come out here. You know, it's not quite an All Quiet on the Western Front, but it would be a very worthy winner if somehow that happened. Okay, costume design. Back to Poor Things and Barbie, as suggested earlier. The torment continues. So when I was talking earlier about, you know, thinking of Barbie for costumes and Poor Things for production design, to put it very broadly, I think you talk about the iconography of Barbie that will linger with us. And I think it is more neon rollerblading and a white fur coat and pink jumpsuits and all of that, more than the Mojo Dojo Casa house. I think giving Jacqueline Duran an Oscar for these costumes is planting a flag on culture in a way that the Oscars, again, like, don't get a chance to do as often as they should. And I really want it to win. I predicted it to win when I wrote up our predictions, and I really want it to win here more than almost anywhere else.
Yeah. When I read that, I was psyched because I was like, yes, I also, you know, I feel that is, this is probably a question for David or the rest of the group. When's the last time a more modern mm-hmm. film mm-hmm. won this category? Because I know
That's
they
the
just
problem.
Love... They love a period piece and flowing skirts.
Sure do.
It's very rare. It's either a period piece or it's Black Panther.
Right.
I mean, it's just, it's really, really rare. Barbie is a singular contender. We don't have movies like this very often, as we were just talking about. So it changes the equation a little bit. But I do think that the work on Poor Things is so strong and so up the Academy's alley that it does feel to me like the trends in this category will win out, especially given that what we were saying about Barbie with production design is also true in costume design. Like, Poor Things has started to beat it in a number of places.
Yeah.
And this feels like a category to me where the trend lines are even clearer for who would win in the end.
I was just looking at Wikipedia. The last contemporary, like, set now thing to win Best Costume Design was Mad Max Fury Road.
Set wow. now? Mad Max is set now?
I
oh,
was
God.
Making a joke about our dystopian times. No, it's like literally, like, it has not happened in decades.
It doesn't happen.
Dang it.
But like, but Mad Max is what I was going to throw out because like Barbie is set now, sort of. Like Barbie World is kind of as foreign a land as the world of Mad Max Fury Road. I feel like gonzo-ness goes a long way. And obviously Poor Things has its own gonzo-ness as well. But I think like that and Black Panther, even Cruella, like have rewarded things that are kind of over the top and distinctive more than like beautiful period work. Which is maybe why Barbie might benefit from that, like, change in the Academy demographics over time.
Yeah, I guess you could make the argument that Cruella, you know, it's a lauded costume designer and it's about fashion. That helped a lot. But also, isn't Barbie about fashion to some extent? Like, you know, you can buy separate fashions for Barbie dolls, you know, in real life. Like, maybe it's not like it's like the winner for best costume design is Manchester by the Sea because Michelle Williams's coat is what real ladies in Boston wear. You know, like it's a great coat. But like, yeah, this is a, something kind
the
of
Boston Oscars really went all the way for Manchester, though.
But yeah, I think you're right that the Barbie is, yes, set in the present tense, but like it's also not. I mean, it's its own thing. I'm predicting Poor Things because I think that that movie's going to do really well in all of the below the line categories. But there's absolutely a strong case for Barbie.
Plus, I think the snoot factor is here again.
Mm-hmm. Yep, snoots are out.
You know, yes. I mean, I love Katie, part of your description, which I agree with, is which of these films will have impacted Halloween costumes for decades to come.
And Napoleon.
It's Barbie.
They have to be vegan, though.
Oh, God.
For Joaquin.
I mean, Bella Baxter is a great Halloween costume, I want to be clear. Like, I don't think it came out in time for most people to have done that, but maybe next year we'll get the Bella
Baxter. Put your baby in a Bella Baxter costume, and it's walking around like Bella Baxter. It's perfect.
That would be pretty irresistible. The long hair would be a real tripping hazard for the baby, but, you know, a small price to pay. All right, I'm going to stick to my guns on Barbie on this, but it is going to be close. I guess I believe in the Academy snoot factor, but I also sort of believe in a broader group of people who would like to do right by Barbie. I don't know.
I agree with you on that. I mean, that's what I was saying in production design. There is something to that. It just depends on where that's going to pop.
Yeah. Okay, on to best editing, which I think is a little bit easier to figure out. Despite the presence of genuine icons like Thelma Schoonmaker, David, you predicted Jennifer Lame for Oppenheimer for this one.
Yeah, as Richard has said on this podcast, a posthumous win because no one can survive such an effort. A line that has stuck with me because it feels very true. We haven't seen Jennifer in a while, or I haven't, so.
Email the podcast. Tell us you're okay.
I did just Google her. She appears to be close enough to my age that I'm jealous. Just, you know, putting that out there.
But she looks 90.
Yeah, this is her.
No, you found Thelma Schoonmaker.
Whoops. This is her first nomination. She has worked with Nolan before. She was known for her work with Noah Baumbach before this. So it's very exciting and it's very deserved. I mean, my God, it's a heroic effort to stitch that thing together and keep that pace and that sense of narrative logic. Pretty amazing. I think Anatomy of a Fall is like the zone of interest of sound. You know, and a zone of interest is in sound. Anatomy is kind of editing here. It is even further back. But if anything were to pull off an upset, I think it is the movie that is the most notably nominated, the most unusually nominated. It's very difficult for international movies to get editing nominations. And it's a movie where it shows in the work again. But I just don't think that there's remotely enough there to overtake what Oppenheimer accomplishes.
I did just Google her and learned that she went to Wesleyan, which is where I went to college.
Dang!
And I think you should stop who knows where this is going
to
go?
Well, like, but also, like, I don't know her, so she's either younger or older than me, and I'm just going to have to figure this out. So, Jennifer, if you're listening.
She was your freshman year roommate, Katie.
If you find out she lives in Durham, look in the mirror for 20 seconds and just take a deep breath.
So if you edit Oppenheimer, you either die or go into a fugue state and forget that you ever did it. Sorry, Kara, I cut you off.
No, I will say I have a soft spot in my heart for Laurent. I got to interview him with Justine, and they have I'm sure this happens with a lot of editors and filmmakers, but they have like the most adorable, like working married couple vibe. They've been working together for like 15 years, and they just, the back and forth of their conversation, I think my favorite thing Justine said is that she has like a 3-hour, 10-minute version of Anatomy of Fall that she would do as a director cut, and Laurent was like, no, don't let her back in this editing room. Like, post-production was crazy. But I'm just happy he's here, and I hope for more of their films to come, despite that, obviously, Jennifer let's find her and talk to her about this.
I'm imagining Katie like Gina Davis in The Long Kiss Goodnight. She's just like in her kitchen and all of a sudden, instead of throwing knives like in that movie, she just starts editing a film. And she's like, wait a second.
I want to take nothing away from Jennifer Lame's incredible accomplishment. I could not do this under any circumstances, but I do want to be friends. Can we just, can we make that happen so I can marvel in real life? Okay, on to Best Cinematography and back right around the corner to Oppenheimer. I wrote up our predictions. I did say Hoyte van Hoytema would win. But David, I did want to give it to you because you interviewed him with Jordan Peele last year for Nope, which was just one of the most crazy, not crazy snubs, because I think Nope got not the treatment it deserved around the board. But
it was, though.
But his work on that was so incredible. And it does feel nice that 1 year later, we're back here being like, yeah, he's just going to win an Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, the general trajectory of his career, it is pretty wild that this is going to be his first win. I interviewed him for Oppenheimer 2, and you can just look at this, the behind the scenes stills of him like with this giant IMAX camera like right in Cillian Murphy's face, and yet out of that he makes something incredibly beautiful and innovative, and he has done that with every movie I've seen of his. He's just an unbelievable talent, and this one feels really overdue.
David, you said I interviewed him for Oppenheimer 2, and I sort of was like, a sequel?
Yeah, I heard myself say it that way. And
dear God, there's more?
Don't give Chris any ideas.
I will note that when I wrote this up, I realized all of the nominees would be first-time winners, including people like Rodrigo Prieto.
And Matthew Lateke. I mean, those are two huge names in the industry.
Huge names. Yeah.
Ed Lochman.
And Robbie Ryan.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of these people
great group.
Hopefully will win someday, but it certainly is Hoyte's turn. And what a beautiful head of hair on that man. I can't wait to see how he styles it for the Oscars.
The Lochman nomination is fun because it's like, oh, right, the tradespeople who do this same work are the ones doing the nominating. You know, you see that with the score, that the American Fiction score that Kara mentioned. Like, it's just fun when one of those things happens where it's like, no, we on the inside know how good El Conde looked, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, and I feel like that happens every year. There's some cinematography nomination that we just totally miss because it's a movie that's not like fully on our radar. And then afterwards you're like, oh yeah, okay, that guy makes sense.
People on or listening to this podcast may not know just how close the Russo Brothers film Cherry was to a cinematography nomination.
Really?
But it was very close. It got a Guild nomination.
Wow. Whew.
Wow. It had a lot of support in that branch.
You're the first person to mention that movie in about 2 years.
Since the Oscar nominations.
Tom Holland just sat up in a cold sweat somewhere.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Okay, let's go on to Best Documentary Feature. Kara, you are in-house expert. You watched all of the films for a piece that you did for us. It's kind of on a guide to what they're about and kind of the broader social consciousness of all of them, which is interesting because some of the films we thought would be nominated, like American Symphony and the Michael J. Fox movie, were a little bit more celebrity-driven and didn't make it in. So this is a heavy-hitting lineup, but I think with one pretty clear winner, right?
Yes. Yeah, I really enjoyed exploring this category a little bit more because we had talked about it before with the nominations. And I think David, of course, helped educate me that this branch has become a little bit more international. And it was a surprise to everyone that none of the American films were nominated. However, this group of nominees, I happily put myself to the task to watch them all. They are pretty intense, but so important. I think 20 Days of Maribel really is the front runner here. It is a harrowing watch. I don't use that word lightly. It's an incredible feat that these really brave journalists decided to keep their cameras rolling the entire time in hospitals, in battlefields, like when this city was under siege. They were trapped, so they couldn't they just kept the cameras running, and they were really the only people that were sending dispatches from this horrific event. So it's a pretty incredible piece of filmmaking. And another moment that I think is stuck out of this award season is that Chernov, I cannot pronounce his first name, I really apologize for that, but he won the DGA for his film as well. And on the day that he accepted that award, he said that his hometown was now being attacked and bombed. So it was just like one of those things that's just so powerful and also pretty tragic. But the other four nominees are equally incredible in kind of shining light in very specific ways in different parts of the world, like things that are incredibly important and devastating that deserve the attention. So I highly recommend watching all five of these.
Yeah, they're all pretty available. They're not, most of them are able to watch at home, right?
Yes. Most of them, I think.
I predicted 20 days as well. And I think that it's interesting that if it wins, it's the second movie in a row after Navalny to be a sort of hard look at current, Russian foreign policy, let's say, and domestic policy as well in Navalny's case. And I think that it just has the kind of like urgent oomph behind it. Whereas, like Four Daughters was on my best of the year list. It's really great. It's really interesting. It's documentary, but it's also kind of staged, and it's I just think that like for the kind of really like you are there quality of 20 days, it's unbeatable.
Yeah. And Four Daughters did win the Independent Spirit Award. Mm-hmm. It definitely has a lot of love, and the fact that it kind of premiered at Cannes. But again, all five of these are really different and incredible in different ways.
Last year, Navalny came up kind of at the last minute. It seemed like it was going to be between All the Beauty at the Bloodshed and Fire of Love. And that is a win that has quite unfortunately, I think, resonated given recent world events. So I think that probably only bolsters the case for 20 Days in Mariupol to really just continue what this brand, what this category has been honoring and spotlighting specifically.
Okay, let's move on to animated feature, where I think I'm going to disagree with what David predicted in our predictions, but acknowledging it was a tight race. So, Dave, why don't you lay it out for us?
Yeah, this feels like perhaps the clearest, test this year of just how international the Academy has gone, because it's very split between Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse and The Boy and the Heron. And I think most years at this point, I would probably predict Boy and the Heron. It's won a few key awards, including the BAFTA and the Golden Globe. It was a box office hit in the US. It had this narrative of being Miyazaki's final film that seems to be now more of a maybe, but still very well could be. And I think voters are aware of that. And then on the other side of it, you have, I think, for this category, unusually popular, acclaimed, and broadly appealing film in Spider-Verse. And that's where it gets tricky. Spider-Verse won PGA, and it also won the Annie Award. It was a box office phenomenon when it came out. When did it come out? Long time ago.
Late May, early June.
Yes. The beginning of summer, that's right. For me, this came down to, like, let's presume, because this is a case in most categories, that many voters have not seen either movie, or at least a good chunk of them haven't, and they're going to watch them on their portal at home. I see Boy and the Heron stumping more voters than Spider-Verse, and I see Spider-Verse, because it's already so well-liked, I wrote was it has a higher floor than Boy and the Heron. And in a race this close, that kind of made the difference for me. I would love to see Boy and the Heron win, and I would love to see the Academy go in a different direction than where they usually go in the animated race. And they really can. I think I'm being a bit cynical. As someone who likes Spider-Verse, I'm not mad about it, but I think I am being a bit cynical here by saying I don't think they'll quite take that leap.
When I was trying to predict this for my ballot, I was like, well, Miyazaki, he wins every time. No, he's been nominated four times and only won once. And I think that, like...
And it was for, like, Spirited Away. It was for
And I think his movies, why people love them is that they're very idiosyncratic. They're strange. They are, at times, like Boy and the Heron, hard to follow, And I wonder if that is kind of a hindrance for it in this case. on the Spider-Man side of things, which I ultimately predicted, I do wonder if because the movie ends, sorry, spoiler alert, on a real cliffhanger, because it's really part mm-hmm. one of two, or it's the middle of a trilogy. I wonder if people will be like, maybe we'll wait to vote for the, you know, like kind of Return of the King winning everything, not Two Towers or the first movie. But I don't know. I still think that the animation itself, forget the plot, forget all that, of Spider-Verse is unique. And I think people will kind of go for that.
I landed on that half of a movie thing as a ding against it, as a say, you know what, like it's good, it's an accomplishment. We already gave it to the first one. Like, we have a chance to give Miyazaki possibly his last opportunity for an Oscar. Not that I think he will show up or is all that bothered by any of this, and God bless him for it. You know, Spider-Verse was a huge hit, is really popular. It does have that like that PGA populist streak going for it. And I admit I am selectively choosing where I think Academy snobbery exists and doesn't exist. but I just feel like just a teeny bit of extra snobbery. There's just not a super strong reason to give it to the second Spider-Verse movie when there's a third one coming. And I do think there is a strong reason to give it to Miyazaki. And that's why I would go there.
Most cynically, if they had really hammered home, it is Miyazaki's final film. But then I think my headline when I reviewed it from Toronto is like, it's a beautiful send off to Miyazaki. And then Miyazaki was like, I'm not done.
But that really is the point. I mean, I think that narrative, if that were a bit clearer and stronger, it would have a more obvious path.
But he's so, like, no.
Cynically, I do
I'm
agree
not playing
with
that game.
It is interesting to think of that and also Killers of the Flower Moon, because if like we knew that was Martin Scorsese's last film, it'd be like, wow, what a conclusion. He himself steps on stage in his final film, but Scorsese's the same way. He was like, no, man, I'll keep making movies as long as you let me. Yeah. So, and may they please continue doing so for as long as possible.
Yeah.
A broader point, though, Katie, I know you said you're being selective with Academy snobbery and where it's going to pop up. We have to be, because this is the group that can give Drive My Car Best Picture Director and Screenplay nominations and Jessica Chastain Best Actress for Tammy Faye in the same year.
They
you know?
Sure can.
It's just hard to...
You just drove a car over to Jessica Chastain.
I love Jessica Chastain, but that movie is not... it's not art house.
No, it's no Zone of Interest, I'll say that much.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess speaking of Zone of Interest, Kara, you predicted international feature for us. And sort of seems like a simple choice, despite some strong contenders in there.
Yeah, I just, the love for, similar to the momentum for Anatomy of a Fall, I think that the Zone of Interest has, I mean, they're both Best Picture nominees, but this one has, Zone of Interest has dominated the conversation in this category. Not, you know, not to take anything away from the nominees, because people do really love all those. I have not seen The Teacher's Lounge. That's still one that I need to.
It's really good.
So good.
I know.
And a good time. So it's tense, but like it's not, it's no 20 Days in Mario, Paul. I'll give it that.
It's not a good time for the teacher, no. But it is a good time for the audience.
There you go.
I know that's one. But I feel like there was a lot of love for that one too. But the Zone of Interest, I think, has dominated this category in the precursors as well. And again, has a lot of support and reverence.
I think France is very unbothered, but we would have had an all-timer race to the finish between Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall here, and we were denied
it. I was thinking the exact same thing.
Potential spoiler, I guess, maybe Perfect Days, but I think...
Box office hit?
Box office hit. I think Zone of Interest is just so far ahead of the other movies.
It is.
And, you know, I think Society of the Snow at one point looked like it could be a sort of all quiet, you know, slow burn, but I think that movie is so miserable to watch. I mean, in a good way, because it's supposed to be. That people are turned off by it.
It really is a tough one.
Perfect Days is my favorite of this category. I mean, Zone of Interest is an incredible achievement, but chilling, I think Richard had in his initial review, is like an understatement. But Perfect Days, what a joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Katie and I saw that together in Toronto, and we looked at each other at a finish and like, that was so delightful.
Yeah. I think I've done this before on this show, but I keep doing it. You look up on Box Office Mojo, Perfect Days has made $20 million around the world. It's incredible what a huge hit this is.
For a movie where like not a lot happens, you know, that's really impressive. Yes.
But anybody can see it. You know, I would recommend Perfect Days to anyone who can tolerate subtitles, really. And I think that bears out in the box office.
Do you guys know that a Zone of Interest made more in the U.S. than Tar?
Wow. What?
Yeah.
Art houses are back.
Wow. Art houses are back.
Tar, not an easy sit, but I would say easier than Zone of Interest.
I mean, Cate Blanchett, you would think, could bring in more than Sandra Hüller.
Zone of Interest. So Perfect Days is just under $20 million worldwide, and Zone of Interest is just over it. Man.
Wow.
What a lovely thing to see.
I didn't realize Tar didn't have that. I saw Tar so late in that season.
It was the year of the art house collapse. It was horrible. And I remember like Women Talking kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And
yeah.
I don't even remember when it came out. I could not even approximate its box office for you, but I'm sure it was very low.
But all of Lydia's comeback concerts have been selling out. Symphony Hall.
It's Maestro counter programming.
Oh God.
Okay, now we're heading into are these top line screenplays top line categories? I never remember where we draw the line.
They're considered among the big five, right?
It's above the line. It's actually a technical term because it's like the pre-production categories.
Yeah, we actually had a listener question about that, David, and I don't know if now is the detour to take it, but I am very curious about above versus below the line since I never knew that definition.
Oh, right, because I had said casting was above the line, which it is.
Yeah,
it's when that work shows up at that point. So yeah.
Wow, fascinating. Okay, so here we are in adapted screenplay, which I took on. I do suspenseful categories mm-hmm. we'll have. And we'll get to Best Actress, but like in terms of like the top major categories, it's really up there. I went with Cord Jefferson for American Fiction, kind of with my fingers crossed behind my back saying it could be Barbie or it could be Oppenheimer. Those all feel like plausible outcomes from this. And I'm very surprised to say Oppenheimer because I feel like for a long time we were like, well, Christopher Nolan wrote the screenplay. He's going to win director. Not to spoiler predictions, but come on. But as we've been saying, as David pointed out, a front runner can kind of build up steam, to make
especially
force.
In screenplay.
Yes. And the adaptation of Oppenheimer is really phenomenal. I don't think you have to have read American Prometheus to kind of understand what a feat of adaptation it is. Barbie is less of a feat of adaptation because it's kind of taking a concept more than a story. But the script for Barbie is remarkable in so many ways. It is a huge part of its power as a pop culture juggernaut. But then American Fiction, as we have said, I think last week talking about the BAFTAs, fits that model of the big breakout talent winning for a screenplay award. It overperformed with nominations. It won't win anything else except for this, unlike Barbie. And that might be why I would go with it, mm-hmm. in addition to kind of a sense of momentum. I think a screenplay win for Barbie would have felt likelier if it weren't for those snubs, if it weren't for the sense of people kind of being ready to move on for it. It's really hard to gauge the desire to give Barbie what it deserves versus saying, okay, you have enough. And I think with a really clear alternative in American Fiction, as someone who, like Greta Gerwig was with Lady Bird, is like a big, exciting voice in the industry, it feels like an easy spot for that to win instead. Mm-hmm. Not easy, but plausible.
I think, and I don't mean this in any sort of pejorative sense, but I think that American Fiction has the added benefit of it flatters the audience. It makes people feel smart and erudite mm-hmm. and like they're having a sort of like entertaining cultural lesson, you know? So it has this kind of, and Barbie also has that, obviously, like it's about big social things, but I think American Fiction harkens back to like James L. Brooks and movies like that. It feels old fashioned, but also kind of, strikingly new. And it's exciting in a way that, Barbie is exciting too, but it was exciting last summer. And I think that it maybe lost a little momentum here. And Cord Jefferson has, he won the Spirit Award. He's been kind of on a nice little run recently. So I agree with you, Katie.
Yeah, these are strong arguments. I agree with you all. If Cord or Barbie's Greta Noah sneak out a win, I'll be psyched.
I'm also on the American Fiction train here. It's won also basically everything. And when it won BAFTA, that for me was like, I will not predict anything else because it wasn't nominated anywhere else at BAFTA. They didn't care for it. And the fact that it had surged to that extent in this race, why wouldn't the Academy follow suit when it overperformed the nominations with them? It feels like that is a natural legacy for this movie. I think it really is a classic kind of breakout screenplay winner, like you were saying, Katie. Something that it took me a while to see, to be honest. But I'm pretty firmly on that train.
And look, Hollywood loves Gawker writers. Just loves them.
Richard, will the Gawker alumni send up like smoke signals to each other when one of your own wins an Oscar?
Something's going to happen. I mean, the big leader, we used to have in the offices, Nick Denton put up TV screens that would was a leaderboard of writers' traffic. So like if your name was like number one for the day, you were really excited. So if Cord Jefferson wins an Oscar, he's number one forever. That's it. He won.
I do think that no matter what, I mean, if no one wins, I think I would not begrudge him at all. Like I said, it's a feat of adaptation, but I think they'll be like, all right, this guy's going to be back. Okay. But I think either Cord Jefferson or Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach winning would be a thrill because of the suspense here. So maybe there's a benefit to it being so tight, even if you would like all of them to win. Okay. Yeah. From one married couple in the race together to another one, David, would you like to explain how Anatomy of a Fall became the odds on favorite here and who might beat it anyway?
We can maybe thank the Golden Globes.
Thank you, Golden Globes.
Mm. They put Justine Triet and Arthur Harari on their stage for screenplay. At the time, it was a thrilling surprise. And ever since then, it has just marched its way toward this award. It won the other televised award for BAFTA. It feels like the place to honor this movie. And we'll talk about actress in a little bit. I have some thoughts there. Spoiler alert. But I do think that most voters are aware that this is where it can easily win a competitive Oscar. And the Academy loves it. So I think that the support will go there. At this point, I do think it's kind of a done deal. But it is worth noting that this is a really, you know, fresh and rich category with movies that I think that these voters really like. Past Lives won the Spirit Awards for Best Feature and Best Director for Celine Song, who also wrote the movie. And that can signal just a level of momentum. I think it was pretty assured to win those, but still it's in the same kind of place as a Women Talking Best Picture nominee with only a screenplay nominee alongside it. So that will definitely help it get some votes for the big fans of that movie. And then there's The Holdovers, which has always been percolating. It's always been around. It's very well liked. My conspiracy theory is that if Alexander Payne had a writing credit on this movie, it would be more competitive, which is, you know, obviously of no fault of David Hemmingson's, the writer who wrote a lovely screenplay. But I think it would make it easier for people to vote for the film and vote for an Alexander Payne film.
Hmm. It is funny to me that The Holdovers is such a writerly, funny, like eloquent script that it feels like should be a really strong front runner. But it's a testament to what we've been saying for months that this is a great year. There's not really bad nominees anywhere. Yep. And really great movies can just become also rans because there's too much competition.
I think what's fascinating is that of this category, which also includes Maestro, a heavily campaigned film that is a Best Picture nominee, and May December, which deserved far more than this nomination, Anatomy of Fall is the strongest overall contender in this five. And that is a really remarkable, steady trajectory for this movie since Cannes. It has held to such an amazing degree. And that's not something that I think any of us would have thought a few months ago when you had Holdovers and Past Lives looking as strong as they were.
Yeah. I don't feel like Justine and Arthur have leaned into the fact that they are a married couple who wrote a really interesting movie about a fractured marriage.
Interesting and, is like, you know, such like, a small word for what they managed to accomplish.
I would say magnificent. But I would love to, you know, because I think people kind of joke about working with their partners in this business and the fact that they work together and it was about such a charged topic, I think is pretty delightful.
And on the cynical side, the big climactic fight is in English. I think that helps.
Also, it happened on March 4th, which is the day before we were recording this. I saw someone tweet that it was, you know, happy of a fall fight day.
Is that the new Mean Girls Day?
Exactly. It's a new Mean Girls Day. It would be great to see Greta and Noah and then Justine and Arthur present or accept their awards back to back. It's not at all impossible. Okay, we're up to the acting awards. Maybe we can make this quick. There is no reason that Robert Downey Jr. will not win Best Supporting Actor. I mean, it would be very lovely to see many of these people win instead. I think it's a great group of nominees, as we keep saying over and over again. But I don't even feel bad about like Ryan Gosling not winning for Barbie. You know, there's something undeniable about Downey here.
Yep.
I would love to go back to our Oppenheimer episode because I feel like this is something we really clearly predicted in July. Yeah. But I could be wrong.
It's the one category
obvious.
Like months and months and months ago that we were like, yeah, that's probably going to happen, right? And then there was a little bit of doubt when the Melton stuff was happening. And I think I'll speak for myself. I sort of talked myself into a weird, like, wait, is that going to happen? But no, Downey Jr. won this Oscar the day the movie premiered.
Yeah.
I will say, controversial opinion or a hot take potentially. I saw Oppenheimer so late, as I've talked about catching up on my awards movies. So the hype train for Downey Jr. was well on its way out the gate. And I wasn't as dazzled by his performance as the rest of the people in this category, I have to say.
Wow.
But his campaign was, it's been strong. He's been like so game for everything the whole time. I mean, I don't hate at all that he's going to win, but the other performances here, I'm just like, oh, I preferred them.
He didn't need to run the strongest campaign, but he ran a hell of a campaign.
Yep.
It is, in a way, the culmination of what has essentially been a 16-year comeback, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I mean, it's insane to think that, you know, like 16 years, like he's been a huge movie star since Iron Man 1, but like, and he was before.
Iron Man 1 was 16 years ago, unfortunately, which, but we're all 26.
I guess somehow. but you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, okay, so he did the huge commercial thing. He's been kind of self-deprecating about that on this award circuit.
Yep.
And now they get to say, like, welcome back to like being a real capital A actor like you were in the old days, you know? And that's hard to beat.
And as his buddy Mark Ruffalo pointed out on this very podcast, Robert does a lot of stuff behind the scenes for other people in this business.
It's true.
Again, I have zero. I mean, he's always been great, but yeah.
You know who deserved more of a run here? Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
He's so good in that movie.
Yeah. One of the performances of his career, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, speaking of people who don't need to campaign, like he doesn't need to campaign, but he didn't. And it seemed like he really would. You know, like the man's got other things to do.
He got mad that he couldn't talk about Donald Trump. And then he was like, all right, see you guys in February.
Robert De Niro's reticence to do any sort of promo is so funny. I went years ago. There was a Tribeca Film Festival panel and it was Meryl Streep, Judd Apatow, Robert De Niro talking about, it was like the 100th anniversary of Universal Pictures. And it was moderated by someone from Deadline, and Meryl Streep last minute dropped out because she had a cold. So it was just these three guys on stage, and all the moderator was doing was asking Robert De Niro questions about The Deer Hunter. And it was just so apparent that Robert De Niro was like, I run this damn goddamn festival, so that's why I'm here, but I do not want to be here at all. And Judd Apatow had to like intervene and basically save the day. De Niro is very press shy, I guess the phrase would be, but had he campaigned, I don't think it would have mattered.
No, it'd be hard for him. I mean, given that he didn't even get nominated for The Irishman, and another incredible performance just a few years ago, it does feel like he's being underappreciated while still getting nominated. I think that is a thing. But also, I think he's fine. Yeah. He's got his
Oscar. I will say, Mr. De Niro did the cover of People magazine this season, my friends.
Well, Carrie, you don't work. You're working for us now. Not for
I know, but I was shocked. I was like shocked to see that come through my social feeds. I'm like,
you know, the campaigns are happening even if we don't notice them.
Not the campaign we'd expect from Robert De Niro.
No,
right?
2024.
Well, he married a British royal. I mean, so he's going to be on the cover of People. I mean.
Okay, on to Best Supporting Actress. The supporting categories are so locked in place. Dame Andrea Randolph, I mean, in a way that I think is more interesting than Robert Downey Jr. He has the whole comeback narrative. He is a giant star. We knew he was going to win from the beginning. I think when The Holdovers premiered at Toronto, we say, wow, she's so great in this. I really hope they can make a campaign of that. And then it just never stopped. She just marched and marched through the whole thing. And I think if you look at her fellow nominees now, Naiad and The Color Purple are not especially strong as Oscar contenders, so you see why Daniel Brooks and Jodie Foster can be overlooked there. America Ferrera kind of snuck in for Barbie, I think a very well-deserved nomination, but you know, it's a smaller part compared to some of the other ones. And then Emily Blunt's part in Oppenheimer has been, you know,
we don't have Rebecca here
to sigh. I think she's terrific in Oppenheimer. I'm obviously an Oppenheimer partisan, but she's not the most important part of that
movie.
You're
Jennifer Lame.
I am Jennifer Lame. I made her part what it is.
Editing her was a pleasure.
I think, you know, Dame Andrea Randolph, you could maybe argue, is a third lead more than a supporting actress. Mm-hmm. It's certainly, you know, the biggest part of all the nominees here. So that explains some of the power of how she's marched through it. But also, she's a great campaigner, a great performance, and she's just going to win.
I hate to bring in my screen time fact check, but Jodie Foster is actually the biggest performance here in terms of
I was just hoping you'd come around to Naiad so we could talk about it a little bit.
But yeah. But how many of those shots are of Annette Bening in the water with Jodie in the background, like waving? Like,
what percentage? Mm-hmm. Or she yells.
There's yelling. Well, Jodie Foster also plays all the jellyfish, so.
I agree with you, though, Katie. I think that this is the dominance here is an interesting story, even if it does feel so telegraphed and done at this point. It wasn't that way. I mean, I guess when she won New York Film Critics Circle, we all just started to realize that this was unstoppable.
It's like it clicked into place and never budged.
Yeah, and that can happen, certainly, especially in this category. But I think that the unique thing about her candidacy is the alignment between every major critics group and every major televised awards show. Like, if you mm-hmm. think of somebody like Allison Janney for I, Tonya, it couldn't have been more obvious. But the critics actually went mostly for Laurie Metcalf that year. Mm-hmm. Or I think even with Laura Dern and Marriage Story, probably a more similar case to Robert Downey Jr. It was in a more scattered field when it came to what the critics were recognizing. This one, it's just like every single person has, you know, essentially chosen her, and I'm thrilled for her.
Okay, we'll do Best Actor before we get to the big title card match of this year's Oscars. I think when Cillian Murphy won at SAG, David, I think you just texted me and said, it's over, which is maybe a simple way of boiling down what has been a race between him and Paul Giamatti. But I do mostly agree with you with what you wrote in our predictions. So I'll let you explain it from there.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely rare for an actor to win both SAG and BAFTA in this category and then not win the Oscar. I don't even remember the last time that that's happened. So as far as I can tell, it's kind of done. Cillian Murphy is in the Best Picture frontrunner. He has won every notable industry award. He had a really strong phase two campaign. I feel like Universal kicked that into gear at just the right time. I was very impressed with that. Because a lot of the focus in phase one was on Emily Blunt and Robert Downey Jr. And it just, you know, at this point, it would be very, very weird if Oppenheimer had this huge embrace, its actor had won all these precursors, and then he lost to Paul Giamatti, who is wonderful in the holdovers. But if Paul Giamatti doesn't win with SAG, and that's his group, I just don't see how this is where he pulls off an upset. It doesn't quite compute for me.
Yeah, I figured. I mean, I kind of expected Cillian to potentially just like become our winner, but I really wanted Paul to win the SAG just to have one little upset.
Yeah,
precursor.
Fun.
Yeah.
I will be rooting for Paul Giamatti. I think I think Cillian Murphy will win as well. I will root for him in general in life. I think I said to somebody, like, I think now Giamatti wins an Oscar in the next 5 years. You know how that happens? Like, Colin Firth gets his nomination for A Single Man and then wins the next year. Like, that happens. And I think that he has such a head of steam behind him. And hopefully the role will come and make that possible, because I think he certainly deserves it.
Yeah.
Here's a text message that I sent to David Canfield and Rebecca Ford, August 22nd, 2023. Wow. How does he not win? Sorry, Cillian. Who was I talking about? I was talking about Bradley fucking Cooper.
You were talking about Bradley Cooper.
No!
So don't listen to anything I ever say on this podcast. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
The unpredictability of a maestro campaign is not something any of us
this was pre-Venice. I didn't know how it was all going to go. I agree with the Murphy thing. I mean, the stat alone about BAFTA and SAG, like, yeah, that's really good indication. And I don't think that this should be talked about like, oh, Cillian Murphy just got swept up in the Oppenheimer momentum. I think that like he stands alone, separate of that phenomenon, as a really beloved actor who does a really interesting bit of acting. And it's fun to see a more like recessive, quiet performance, you know, potentially for now, you know, win a big Oscar like this.
Plus, he is just a little more reserved, which I think is really charming, you know. I have enjoyed both sets of speeches along this trail. Paul's, I think, was the Globes, that was like his first moving one.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, Go forth, Killian.
I was thinking when I was seeing Dune 2, to bring it up again, there's a lot of IMAX close-ups in that movie, as there are in Oppenheimer. And it made me just kind of reflect on the power of close-ups on Cillian Murphy's face in Oppenheimer and how absorbing they are and kind of what a special effect they are in and of themselves. And yeah, as we keep saying, like when a movie is winning a lot, it keeps winning. And he is the movie as much as the cinematography or the editing or the score. And when you kind of see it, when you see the dust clear, you're like, oh, yeah, of course he has to win. So I look forward to seeing his speech.
Yep.
Okay, let's do Best Actress. We have gone back and forth about this. It's always going to be our favorite category to talk about. I think even in years when it's not actually that suspenseful, we're gonna gravitate back to it again and again. But I think very similar to last year, where it was down to Cate Blanchett and Michelle Yeoh, we are down to Lily Gladstone and Emma Stone, the Infinity Stones, as they call each other, and now I call them. We predicted Lily Gladstone. Kara, you wrote it. Do you want to run down why?
I think the after Lily won SAG, I think that was what helped solidify this one in my mind. It's been interesting the whole way through, because I didn't think that Emma would have. I mean, I absolutely think she deserves a nomination and another Oscar, but I'm still surprised that the Academy so wholly embraced Poor Things. So Lily's just the heart of that movie. You know, I think there was the little bit of conversation about, you know, whether supporting or best actress, but it seems you know, all of it's so legit to me, and her story is great. She's, I think, David, you talked last week about her presence in the room and how mm-hmm. she's kind of come into her own this season, and will hopefully get to do so much more after this season and with a win.
I feel like there's a potential spoiler here in Sandra Hüller. Where Gladstone and Stone split a vote. I just want to take us back a few years. Here's something I believe I wrote. The only potential spoiler here could be if too many voters figure close a lock and then vote for another personal favorite like Olivia Colman. But that seems pretty far-fetched at this point. I just think going into this category with conventional wisdom often serves you well, yes. But like sometimes last-minute passion picks can succeed like they did in Olivia Colman's. And I just think that if of the five, Hüller is really lurking there for a movie that, like as David said earlier in this episode, the Academy loves. So that would be an interesting development were that to happen. But I think you're right, Kara, in predicting Lily at the moment.
But not that I don't. I mean, listen, we are craving a surprise, right? Like, I would love, give us some surprises Sunday.
All extremely deserving, which is nice. Like, we don't have to be bummed if it's, you know, like a Rami Malek situation or anything like that.
Sure.
Sorry to Rami, who I think is great in other things.
Great in Oppenheimer.
Well, he's good in Oppenheimer.
Let me be a partisan, all right?
I don't know. I don't know if he's in the top 10 of that movie, but I agree with Richard. There is also this X factor of a lot of Academy members discovering the zone of interest at the same time that Anatomy of a Fall is surging, and Sandra just being this face of the international transformation of the Academy, giving two completely different, equally brilliant performances, only perhaps helpfully nominated for one of them. I think she's going to get a lot of support. I do not think it will be enough, given that this has been such a seesaw between the two. I'm like 51. Well, no, I do think Sandra's like in a, you know, lower. I'm probably like 41 Lily, 40 Emma, 20 Sandra.
Wow, like watching it, you do that math. Wow.
I 19 Sandra, I guess, would be 100.
Yeah, there we go.
We've been recording a long time. My sense of logic is slowly dissipating. The reason that I would go with Emma is that I think that there is more love for Poor Things overall. That seems kind of clear by the fact that we've talked about it so much more just in this conversation, as in conversation for other wins. She has won an Oscar before, but that doesn't, I don't think that, you know, prohibits voters from giving people additional Oscars rather quickly. Just ask Frances McDormand, who's also won because she was in the stronger movie, Nomadland.
Same with Jodie Foster's second Oscar win, which happened just four years after her first.
We talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the reason for Lily is, number one, the narrative is really strong, and it's something that she has been really central to for that movie from the very inception of that campaign. Really smart move by Apple, is paid off. And it's in some ways what Best Actress can do, which is a Discovery Award. Lily Gladstone's been in this industry for a number of years, but for a lot of people watching that movie, it was like a holy shit, who is this moment?
Yeah.
And I think that that has a, this is the category, whether it's even somebody like Brie Larson for Room, where that can happen. So those are the two sides. The reason I went with Lily in the end is she won SAG, and SAG is later, happened during voting. And so I guess if you want to sign a momentum, there it is. But I mean, to me, it's just so close.
Yeah.
Plus, one question I have, David, you might answer this, is how often does the Academy like to make history? Because there's also that part of Lily's story, which is excellent.
I don't think you can predict that way. I mean, I don't think that they... I think they actually resist that, to be honest with you. Like, I don't think Michelle Yeoh won because of that. I think she won because she gave a great performance in the movie that they liked the most, you know, and they didn't end up liking Tar that much. Just to use last year's example. So I don't think that they vote that way. I think that they can fall in love with a story and a person on the trail. And that is sort of synonymous with making history this year. So... it's a factor, but I think that it would have to come down to, you know, them loving the performance.
Yep.
I do wonder if we're in for some internet chaos if Lily doesn't win. For, you know, we've been talking about it internally a little bit, like the people who don't follow it that closely, who don't know that Emma Stone is like right there in the running and how popular Poor Things is, and have been kind of sold this idea that the Academy could make history. I don't know how much we want to base what we predict on Twitter meltdowns, but it does seem like something that could happen. And I want to at least be emotionally prepared for it, even if I think there would be very good reasons for either of them to win.
The Oscars is weirdly, the Academy is weirdly like, I don't want to use the word good, but they are very adept at tuning all of that out.
Yes.
You think about Hopkins beating Chadwick Boseman a couple years ago, where the kind of social sentiment, the popular sentiment was like, give Chadwick Boseman, an amazing actor, this posthumous award. People thought it was going to happen so much so that they moved that category to the end of the show. And the Academy...
Steven Soderbergh specifically.
Yeah, I love Steven's work, but not that, maybe. But, you know, and then that's not what happened, because a lot of these Academy voters barely even know what Google is, let alone Twitter. So, yeah, I think it's hard to factor that in. I mean, it would be amazing if that history was made on Sunday, but we'll see.
We really do underestimate that as a crazy Oscar moment. Like, it's sandwiched between Moonlight, La La Land, and The Slap. And so it kind of gets overshadowed. But that was such a crazy thing that happened at the Oscars.
Anthony Hopkins wasn't even there. Like, it was just a total mess.
Joaquin Phoenix is just standing there.
They didn't let
there.
Him zoom in.
I think he was asleep. Wasn't it like 3 in the morning in Wales or wherever he was? Anyway.
Yeah, but you weren't allowed to zoom in. You had to be in the remote
I forgot about
hub
that.
Yeah. In London.
Right.
Oh, aren't we so glad?
Where Florian Zeller was there at that place, but Hopkins was like, I'm too old for this shit.
All of us were like prepped to write some big moving thing too.
We all had those pre-writes ready to go.
Boy. Okay, I think we can wrap this up and maybe lump together Best Director and Best Picture, since we expect Oppenheimer to win both handily. We were asked to do kind of an Instagram like state of the race thing, and you'd be like, all right, what do you think is going to be first place, second place in these? I was like, I don't have the first clue what would come in second place in either of these. Like, it's so obviously Oppenheimer in both. I don't know if you guys have a hot take on who could be a spoiler in either, but it's just gonna be Christopher Nolan, and then Emma Thomas, I assume, will give the speech for Oppenheimer for Best Picture.
I think picture, the only spoiler I see at the moment is Zone of Interest, weirdly.
That is wild.
I think that movie has a lot of momentum.
Not Anatomy of a Fall.
Anatomy of a Fall, yes, for sure, but I still think there are older members of the Academy, institutional bias. Anatomy of a Fall is a women's picture. You know, I think that, unfortunately, that is a bias that exists. But I don't know. I think Oppenheimer is far and away, because it satisfies both traditionalists and people who are looking at the really kind of cutting edge craft. And it's timely, but also a historical biopic. Like, it's so many quadrants are being filled there.
I think I would buy Jonathan Glazer's second place in the director votes than more than Zone of Interest on a preferential ballot in second place.
Yeah, that's where I'm at too.
Yeah, that's a tough one to pick too, is who would be a second place director.
I honestly don't even know.
Yeah.
I was reading some of the anonymous ballots because I can't help myself. And what's striking is, like, even if Oppenheimer is not first on a ballot, it's like second or third, mm-hmm. maybe fourth. It's just, and it is first on a lot. It's so far ahead. I don't think that this is a race.
Yeah.
I got to get to these anonymous ballots. I've been depriving myself.
Oh, it's not an endorsement.
Yeah. I don't know if I would go down that road. Here's my final question. Do you think Christopher Nolan will be visibly emotional in any way, or will he handle this as placidly and gently as he has everything else?
That is a great question.
I hope he's
I would not mind seeing him get excited.
Full weeping. Yeah. It came true. I deserve this. Ooh. You know, I'm the king of the world.
You like me. You really like me.
Let's do it all.
Just running the greatest hits.
Yeah.
Same question for Killian, I think. I would think Nolan might get more emotional than Killian would be my bet.
Yes. I was thinking the opposite.
That Killian might push sweet, non-emotive Killian.
That's what you always
inch.
Wonder, right? Is like, who's going to break when they finally get to the finish line?
Yeah.
Not break. That sounds bad. Who's going to let it all out once they finally get to the finish
line? I feel like it's
line?
More possible for Killian than for Nolan, just because Nolan, it's been such a steamroll.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Gladstone's been very measured, too. Like, she's kind of really stayed on message. And, you know, I'd be interested about that level of emotionality. I mean, of the four acting winners, Downey Jr. gives the most, like, move. I mean, Davine's speeches have been great, too. I don't know. Yeah. That's a tough call to make, actually.
This one, I will say, Christopher Nolan seemed really pleased, is not the word, but the DGA, he seemed really, really honored. So,
I mean, I think this does mean a lot to him, but I think he's just a kind of measured guy, and that's part of his success. Yeah. I would be interested in, you know, in that part of Oppenheimer where they're taking side bets on whether they'll ignite the atmosphere. I want to see some side bets on who will cry first.
That's fun.
And then maybe we can come up with a metric for most emotional. So that's something else to add to the list for next week.
And which actor or winner will enter the Speed Force? That's something we should be thinking about.
Well, I think we all know that's Killian Murphy. I mean,
of course, he's already in it.
Got his running shoes on. That does it for today's episode. We'll be back early-ish on Monday. We'll be recording our instant reactions episode to the Oscars, to the Vanity Fair Oscar party, to everything else that happens on Sunday night. I hope it all goes well. We hope all of you who wrote us about your elaborate foods that you'll be eating on Oscar Sunday, that it all goes well. Please feel free to send us pictures. Obviously, we'll be covering the Oscars minute to minute on Sunday night. David and Kara will be at the Oscars themselves. Richard and I will be keeping an eye on Vanity Fair's live blog. Yes, live blog, still a thing, and actually a pretty useful way to follow the Oscars and follow along with the rest of us. And if you catch Richard tweeting, you can join me in being like, Richard, put it in the live blog.
Don't
give it all to Elon Musk for free. But yes, we'll have a lot to talk about come Monday. And then we will have another episode next week, just as a scheduling thing. We'll have our Monday episode, and there'll be another surprise coming on Thursday before we resume our regular schedule. So please join us between now and Oscar night, and on Oscar night at vanityfair.com, on social media at VF Awards Insider, and on our own. I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylas, but on Sunday, I'm just on the live blog.
Thank you very much. And David.
David Canfield, 97.
And Kara.
Kara J. Warner.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best prediction for what will win Best Picture next year goes to David Canfield.
Oppenheimer 2.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.